couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Falling, The Reckoning, Rams, Earwig and the Witch, and The Snoopy Show. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at Breakfast of Champions. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Of course, we got the news this past week that Hal Holbrook had died. He had actually died at the end of January, but his family didn't announce the death until the beginning of February. He was 95, and that's a good run. He was a fantastic actor, and one of the things that was great about Hal Holbrook is it was not beneath him to take a movie that was like a horror film. You know, he did Creepshow, which was, I mean, it's a splatter fest. He did The Fog. You know, I mean, he'd done these movies as well as doing these, you know, more esoteric things like Mark Twain and appearing in television and movies. He was a working actor. And I've always had respect for people like that who take the jobs that come to them. Not everybody can be like Daniel Day-Lewis and say, I'm only going to take one role every 10 years and then disappear into obscurity. I think that was one of the wonderful things about Hal Holbrook. So the other rest in peace goes to Dustin Diamond, who's best known for playing Screech on Saved by the Bell. He was 44 and he died of cancer, which he had, we had recently just learned that he had gotten a late stage diagnosis. So this isn't necessarily a surprise in that wake of that news, but it is of course sad when somebody dies that young. And it's interesting because he was sort of estranged from his other castmates on Saved by the Bell, partly because he had dipped his toe into adult filmmaking at a certain point. And I mean, he did like celebrity boxing. This is one of the problems when you have such an iconic character, or rather a unique character, that young, when he was still a child playing Screech, and he had just that distinctive nerdy look to him. I don't think he could ever find anything after that, because it was either going to be a Screech ripoff. He was going to play a nerdy kid, which is why he built up his body and started to get really buff. But that's because he wanted to break out of the Screech role. But then again, nobody wanted to hire him after that. So that's one of the problems about being a child actor, is you get pigeonholed very early, and then you either have to embrace it or find something to embrace about it, or break out completely. So it's sad to see somebody go at that young of an age. The next piece of news, another little piece of news is, and this isn't really movies, it's more the music world. You had all these accusations coming out this week about Marilyn Manson allegedly being abusive. Evan Rachel Wood, who had had a relationship with him, tells her story in, I think, a Vanity Fair article. And other former girlfriends and people in their orbit have come out and corroborated her story, or at least said that they believe her. And this is what I find interesting. This is sort of the wake of the Me Too movement. No matter how abusive Marilyn Manson was to Evan Rachel Wood, there is no real pragmatic way to prosecute that from a legal standpoint, because you need evidence and you need beyond a shadow of a doubt, et cetera, et cetera. And you just don't have that. I mean, at this point, you're talking years ago, word against word. There's no physical evidence, no contemporaneous evidence. But I don't think that's what's going on right here. They're not going after him from a legal perspective. They're trying to go after his career, which is a lot easier to do. And this is what has ultimately taken down. I mean, yeah, sure, Cosby ended up going to jail for stuff because they had certain sort of contemporary evidence to it. Same thing with Harvey Weinstein. But Harvey Weinstein isn't in jail because of all of the accusations. It's just the ones that you could prosecute. The rest of it is your career. And there is a certain chickens coming home to roost to people who are serial abusers or people who are just bad people. Although it's just, I find it interesting this is happening now and it didn't happen several years ago when the Me Too movement really took off. Because as I read this and you start seeing like a label drops him and he starts, you know, suffering career-wise, that's the real objective of something like this. And you know, heck, that's fair game. Because if he wants to sue her for defamation, but again, you'd have to have proof, and then you start bringing up all the evidence of was he a serial abuser or not, and then that becomes very problematic from his side, and that's what's going on here. So, yeah, we'll see what ends up happening with these cases. I think you're going to see a lot more of these showing up. The next piece of news I want to just sort of really breeze through is the Golden Globes nominations. I'm not at all going to go through and talk about anything in really particular, although I will say I'm not a big fan of using the term snub, but I do think that the Five Bloods got snubbed in the Golden Globe nominees because that was a great movie, and Delroy Lindo deserves some credit for the acting job he did. This is the danger of releasing a movie in the summer or spring when you're looking for award season that goes 9 months later. The thing that I did notice with this in the Golden Globe nominations, and this isn't just in the film, but this isn't the television stuff too. There's a lot of streaming stuff. Now you would expect that in the pandemic, because some movies like The Trial of the Chicago 7, I believe was originally intended for a theatrical release, and it did do a qualifying release, but it went to Netflix. So there are some that migrated into the streaming platforms, but this is streaming gear. I mean, if you look at some of the stuff, you know, like I'm just looking at the best actor in a TV series, musical comedy. You got Nicholas Holt for The Great, and you've got Jason Sudeikis for Ted Lasso. Those are both streaming. You don't have those on broadcast television, and you've got that going on with The Crown, is like that. Ozark is like that. Ratchet is like that. It is less and less about broadcast television and more about streaming nowadays. And you're seeing that also in the film categories. That's, I think, where we're headed. I mean, even if you look at like the Best Picture Drama, which is arguably the precursor for the Oscars, Mank and The Trial of the Chicago 7 are both streaming service ones. And then if you look at the musical or comedy, Borat, Hamilton, Palm Springs, and The Prom are all streaming services. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is Coming to America. It comes to Prime on March 5th.
Hey! What are you doing back here? Mufasa!
I've just discovered that I may have a son here in this land.
How much child support is she getting from?
The king pays no child support.
No child support for 30 years and you came back? You was a dummy!
Hello, I am Hakim Jaffer, king of Zamunda. You are the heir to the throne.
Yes, my father.
I always thought that Mika was going to be queen.
Did it ever occur to you that Mika wanted to be your heir?
This looks like it's actually got a story to it now, which is, it's what you'd expect. It's reversing, it's flipping the script. It's bringing him from America to Eddie Murphy's kingdom in Africa. So you're flipping the script a bit, which is a very popular thing to do. The problem is, will it be as fresh and as fun as Fish Out of Water in New York? That's yet to be seen. So the nostalgia factor will only last for so long on this. And, you know, we got to see an actual pragmatic, funny storyline. So it could do it, but it still has an uphill battle in my opinion. We'll see at the beginning of March. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Courier, which is in theaters on March 19th.
This is unexpected. I can't believe I'm actually having lunch with spies. I'm just a salesman.
Exactly. You're a civilian, so the KGB won't be watching.
It would be a real service to Great Britain.
Everyone you meet assume they're KGB. Every Russian is an eye of the state. From now on, you will be selling one thing. The idea that you are an ordinary businessman and nothing more than an ordinary businessman.
This looks actually really interesting. It's got Benedict Cumberbatch playing a somewhat reluctant spy in a real Cold War pragmatic situation, which looks like it might be an interesting film. So I'm looking forward to this one. I just had heard about it and I finally had a chance to watch a trailer. I'll be covering it in about a month or so. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It looks like it might be an interesting movie. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Falling and Rams.
We'll be right back.
guys at the movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Falling. Viggo Mortensen directs this film about a family trying to find a new place for their father to live as he is suffering from dementia.
How was your trip out here, Daddy?
Who cares?
You asked me to come get you. Remember?
I would never say that. Doctor,
doctor. Dad, you know Mom's not here.
Father, Mom. Did you forget because you're too old?
You can attack me all you want, but I am not going to engage with you on that level anymore.
Like, I know what you're trying to do.
There's a couple of points on this one. The first one is it being Viggo Mortensen's directorial debut. And the thing with Viggo Mortensen, he's always plays the tough guy. Basically Aragorn was a tough guy in Lord of the Rings. He's known for that, but he was, you know, did like Eastern Promises, you know, did History of Violence. You know, he's always sort of like the young tough guy, even in something like Green Book, which is a very polarizing movie. He still was, he was a tough guy. He worked with the thick Italian guy from the big city and, you know, he played that sort of character. And this is a very different character for him to play. And I've always thought of him as a tough guy character. But when you look at his life and his career, he does stuff. He does poetry. He does photography. He's a very artistic guy. It's just he has a look and a feel. And so he's in this movie. He directs himself. And I had heard that he was reluctant to do this. And that's comes across because he kind of understates his character. He does not try to steal the scenes, which is great because sometimes when you get actors who become directors, it just becomes all about them emoting for 2 hours. And that's not what he does here. He focuses the story on Lance Henriksen, who plays his father. And he's very generous about it. While he has got a lot of screen time, he lends himself and the performance goes to bolstering Lance Henriksen's performance. And that's really what works about a movie like this. So, yes, bravo for him on the first time directing. He juggles a lot, too. There's a lot going on because the whole story is it's this father who was not a good guy to begin with. The guy was kind of a jerk. He was a bit abusive. He was mean. He was racist. He was homophobic because the character that Viggo Mortensen plays grows up and realizes he's a homosexual and he's now living with a man. And so you have all of that baggage he's carrying because the father was mean to him about that when he was growing up. And, once he and the mother and the father had gotten divorced, he really didn't treat the kids great. And he was not a good guy. And I think what it shows is what families do, even if they got somebody who's not a good person. And that's tough to handle because these kind of situations require sacrifice. And it's really tough to sacrifice yourself for somebody who doesn't appreciate it or doesn't even recognize that they should appreciate it and fights you all the way. I mean, I've had my own personal situation. Everybody has had their own personal situations in dealing with loved ones and family members who need help. I have fortunately been in situations where whenever that's been required, there's an understanding and there's a mutual respect, but that's not always the case. And I think he does a good job handling that. It gets a little bit heavy at times. But the other thing is it spotlights dementia. And I think that's a good thing. That seems to be a theme this year in award films because we had Supernova, we talked about last week with Stanley Tucci. He was suffering from some dementia issues and cognitive decline. And then, of course, in a couple of weeks, we got The Father with Anthony Hopkins coming out. And similarly, he plays a character who's losing his faculties and struggling to keep control. And it's not that they haven't done movies like this. There was that movie Still Alice with Julianne Moore a couple of years ago. And actually, Anthony Hopkins was in the movie Proof, which also dealt with mental decline. It's just that we have these three award films coming out within a couple weeks of each other, and they're all dealing with this. And that's because this is a real thing, and it strikes a lot of people, and they're very different versions of dementia and things that do different things. And it's a struggle. Even if you're a good person and a nice person, it's a worse struggle if you're a bad person. And sometimes, depending on the dementia you have, a lot of times you lose your inhibitions. And so it tends to exacerbate the stuff that you try to hold back normally. So it exacerbates some of the less positive elements of your personality. You know, if you're a worrier, you'll worry more. If you're distracted, you get distracted more. If you're always concerned about your money, you become more and more distracted. You know, and if you're a racist, sexist, homophobic bigot, like this character is in this movie, you just get worse. And that becomes a real challenge. You know, in the nicest situation, it's a challenge. And I think that there's a lot of realism in this. And that's what makes it work. And like I said, Mortensen does a good job understating some of it. There's some heavy-handed first-time directing stuff that's peppered out through. But overall, I think Mortensen handles himself well. And I would say that Falling's worth checking out. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the movie Rams. Two estranged brothers in Australia face hardship when both sheep flocks are struck with a dangerous disease.
And Les Grimason is the winner.
Little Ripper!
Oh, come on, Cole, cheer up.
Right.
You two haven't spoken in 40 years.
Les's ram, he's sick.
Farmers have been shocked by the discovery of a highly infectious disease.
They're mine! Don't take them back!
A control plan has been put in place in the hope of containing the outbreak.
I reckon we spent half our lives in here.
It means everything to them.
That's it, mate. They're taking the whole bloody valley.
Why don't they take us while they're at it?
It's about these two brothers, and they've been estranged for decades, and they have adjoining farms. Sam Neill plays the one of the brothers, and Michael Caton plays the other one. And it's really told from Sam Neill's point of view, and the fact of how much these two men are invested in their sheep and how invested they are in their flocks. That's what they do. That is their life. And when this blight or plague or disease comes through the area, which is very specific to sheep, and they have to destroy their flocks, It's heartbreaking, and each of them handle it very differently. Now, it's being billed as a bit of a comedy. It's not a comedy. It's not heartbreaking either. There are some lighter moments to it, but it's much more of a drama. It's a realistic view of what people do and sometimes have to face. And at times it's very, very sad. And it's effectively done. Sam Neill's great to watch. And of course, he's got all the experience of being a farmer anyways, because if you go to his social media accounts, he's just nothing but him and farm animals. So it shows that relationship a person can have with the animals that they're raising. It's a sort of a intimate story, and it's very, I would say it's very niche, because you have to like this very specific type of story, but it's effectively well done. It's got a good cast. You know, both Neil and Caton do a great job in their roles, just sort of showing how they deal with things differently. Miranda Richardson plays a local vet, and she has a nice interaction with them. So overall, it's a neat movie that exists in something that I don't understand all that well, but it's still worth checking out. For no other reason, for watching Sam Neill deal with animals differently than he deals with dinosaurs. So in all that, I'm going to have to say that this movie kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Earwig and the Witch and The Reckoning. With Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Earwig and the Witch. A girl is left in an orphanage when she is a baby and is later adopted by witches from the same coven.
Erica, you haven't ever wished a family would adopt you, have you?
Nope.
Anybody who'd choose me would be pretty unusual.
We'll take this one. Now then, let's you and I get a few things straight. My name is Bella Yaga. I'm a witch.
Great! You agree that you'll teach me magic, and I agree to help you out.
If you work really hard, I shan't do anything to hurt you.
This is somewhat historical because it comes from Studio Ghibli. It's the first time they've ever done a full CGI movie. Studio Ghibli is famous for being the Japanese studio that does all of those just wonderful films, that we've seen over the years. Disney was distributing a bunch of them, but I think they moved over to HBO Max now. They had stuff like Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Nausicaa and the Valley of Wind, Kiki's Delivery Service, Howl's Moving Castle, Princess Mononoke. I mean, all of these out-of-the-box, forward-thinking films that are just beautifully animated. Hayao Miyazaki is the best-known director from there, although there are other people who've directed some of these films. But Hayao Miyazaki is a legend just in film and cinema, let alone animation. Earwig and the Witch is directed by, I believe, his son. And the big thing is they've moved from their 2D animation, the cell animation, to 3D CGI. And that does not seem to be a great move for Studio Ghibli. Part of what makes Studio Ghibli so charming is their style of animation and the stylized intricacy of how they animate, well, Japan, because most of the films take place in Japan. And how they draw nature and how they do things with the 2D animation that is just gorgeous. I mean, if you've ever seen Spirited Away, which is way out there, same thing with Howl's Moving Castle. These are way, way out there in terms of high concept pieces. They have mystical elements and spiritual elements and magic. And then there's other ones that are a little bit more pragmatic, like Whisper of the Heart, which is really just a love story between two kids, or even something like The Wind Rises, which was, I think, Miyazaki's final movie or close to it. That's the one about planes. And he was a huge aviation fan. And it was about a guy who designed planes in Japan back in the middle of the 20th century. Even those that are very pragmatic have that very wondrous and beautifully stylized approach. When you adapt that to CGI, it looks kind of canned. And because they haven't been like Pixar, which Pixar has been designing their own proprietary software since they started in the 90s, making Toy Story in 1995. And now that they develop these bigger movies, they have an entire person who just does water for the movie or something like that. Because Studio Ghibli has missed the last 20, 25 years of development, they're sort of coming at it from behind. And so their animation is not terribly intricate. It's not well done. It's not well designed. And that's the biggest hit against this movie is, I think if this were done in the 2D style, making everything else the same, do it in the cell animation, I think it would be a much better movie. Otherwise, it kind of looks a little cheap. It looks like it's a low rent CGI. And in trying to emulate the Studio Ghibli look, it just makes it look almost generic because that's sort of what generic CGI looks like. So I think there needs to be a little bit more development, either money thrown into development or finding a way to make the CGI your own. Because they made the cell animation your own. You watch something from Studio Ghibli, you can immediately recognize it. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that they face with Earwig and the Witch, because it doesn't quite make that leap from platform to platform. Now, getting back to the story in the movie itself, it's a charming little film. It's very typical Ghibli, where it has these grand themes, but the themes don't spiral out into the stratosphere. It's about this girl who's trying to reconcile her life as a witch and find her mother who had dropped her off at this orphanage. There's some loose ends with that story that don't quite make sense and don't quite hold up. But there's also elements to it that make it feel a bit like a Roald Dahl story, because you've got this weird couple who adopt her and they've got these strange rules, and one of them seems to be very mean and could, but also isn't at the same time. And that's very Studio Ghibli, where there's something that could be menacing and it turns out that there's a softer side to that. And so I like those themes in here. And overall, the story works as a Studio Ghibli story. It does rely a little bit too much on this background of everybody being in a band together. But overall, I mean, it's a charming movie. It's just stylized, looks not as good because it's not the standard Studio Ghibli style that we've become used to and that they've grown into. And I think they're not just hopping to a new platform. They're hopping to a new platform and they have to find their own look within that platform, and they don't have it yet. So it looks too much like a generic movie, and less like a Studio Ghibli movie. But, you know, sort of like the story elements are there, but it's also because it's a limited film, and the first time they're doing it, they didn't do something as out there and as layered as like Spirited Away or Howl's Moving Castle. So I'm going to have to say Earwig and the Witch kind of rocks, but we need to see some more development before they do much more of this at Ghibli.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is The Reckoning. In the 1600s in Europe, a woman is accused of being a witch after her husband dies of the plague.
The sickness hangs over the city like putrid fog. Bodies are piled high in the narrow streets. It's as if the day of judgment has finally arrived.
I'll give you some advice. Leave town while you can.
I saw her the other day. She was acting bloody peculiar.
There's only one thing that can explain it. She made a pact with the devil.
This is in theaters and on VOD. I think it's also on the Shudder streaming service, if you have that. It's a horror movie. It's directed by Neil Marshall, and he's got his history of horror movies. He did The Descent, which was quite good, and that was about 15 years ago. This one is about this woman who's essentially accused of a witch and then dragged out by the witch finder general and put through all the horrible tortures that went through back 300 or 400 years ago when there were accusations of witchcraft. And it's not done in a fun, charming, hilarious way, the way that Monty Python does it. The biggest problem with this movie is it stars Charlotte Kirk, who's a beautiful woman, but beauty will only take you so far when you've got an entire movie on your shoulders. Now, Charlotte Kirk is not well known, but factually, she is the main squeeze of Neil Marshall, and she helped develop the story. But because of that, I mean, it was clear it was going to be her job anyway. I mean, it's not like she started sleeping with the director to get the role. She was with the director, and they developed this movie together as a vehicle for her. And as beautiful she is, and I'm sure as much fun as Neil Marshall has with her, she's not that great of an actor. She's okay. But for a movie like this, you really need somebody who's got better acting chops. And she just doesn't have them. It's clear when you watch this movie that this was a bigger part than she could fill. Because a lot of it deals with her having flashbacks and having hallucinations. And, you know, like the last half of the movie is sort of like partly a fever dream that she's dealing with as she's going through all these labors and tortures of being accused of witchcraft. And it has these interesting horror elements to it, but it never quite gels because she never quite makes it work. It's rare to see a movie that you're going to feel like you can pin everything on. This is the one problem with it, but she was what makes it harder to watch. I mean, like I said, it's easy to watch because she's pretty, but it gets a little dull when she's just reacting and not doing it as well as she could. And she needs more acting gravitas to bring to this than what she did. For that sense, I'm going to have to give it a kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Snoopy Show and the Home Cinema Roundup with a spotlight on Breakfast of Champions. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the final review, and this is actually of a TV series on the streaming service Apple TV Plus. It drops this week, and it is The Snoopy Show. Apple TV Plus presents this series of shorts about everyone's favorite beagle and his antics.
Look what I have. We're going to be best friends. Don't be nervous. You're going to like it here. Good grief.
Marcy, remind me to never pick that kid with the big nose for gym class.
Thanks for the inspiration, Snoopy.
Do some crazy!
Whoa! Can you believe this dog?
Do something crazy! Do something wild!
For first thing I want to do about that trailer, and I tried to cut around as much as possible. There's this loud music playing, and it's almost like a rap song. That's not Snoopy. That's not Peanuts. It's sort of like when you watch the trailer for a period piece, and they start putting in rock music or rap music around it, and you're like, never see that music in the movie itself, because the movie is done as a piece of cinema that has a soundtrack to it and not just modern music. I mean, the trailer makes it sound like in-your-face, loud, and obnoxious peanut stuff, but it's not, actually. This is authentic Charlie Brown, Snoopy, all the other Peanuts gang in essentially animated versions of the comic strip. When I was a little kid, one of the greatest things that I waited for, because you got to remember, I grew up at a time, I think VCRs existed in the early 70s, but people didn't start having them in their homes until late 70s, early 80s. But even then, they were very expensive, and it wasn't until sometime in the 80s that they became affordable for people. So growing up in the 70s, we didn't have the option of any sort of delayed broadcast. You watched what came through the air at that moment. And one of the greatest things of the year was when they did the Charlie Brown specials. You know, Christmas time Charlie Brown, Great Pumpkin, Easter Beagle, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember just how much I loved those and how unique they were, because they had a very low-key delivery. And even if you go back to the original Christmas time Charlie Brown special, yeah, it has a story of them trying to do the play at school and the Charlie Brown Christmas tree and that side story, but it was just a bunch of gags that were lifted from the comic strip of, like, you know, Sally writing a note to Santa or Linus writing a note to Santa. And that's what I remembered being so charming about those old Peanuts shows. They were just adorable, and I loved them as a kid, and I watch them now, and they're so sweet. It goes back to that vignette storytelling. Each episode consists of 3 7-minute cartoons. And within those 7 minute cartoons, each one has a theme. Like, there's one of them where Snoopy's trying to get Sally's lunch to her at school. But there's a lot of stuff going on in the background, and it is a bunch of, like, just tied together sketches and gags, and that's authentic Peanuts. The other thing is, there's not an attempt to necessarily teach you anything. And I'm not saying that it's bad to have educational programming, and this is not a complaint about the show. Sometimes it's nice to just watch something for entertainment. And one of the things with preschool programming, because this is who it's aimed for, 7 years old and younger, really, it's okay to have a piece of preschool programming that's just there to entertain. That's not trying to teach you sequencing and events. And I mean, that stuff's great as well. But, you know, at a certain point, you get tired of Dora the Explorer. I mean, Dora the Explorer is a great show, but she's like Nicolas Cage. She yells everything at you. And that's really what the Snoopy show is. It is just this sweet, adorable, nostalgic, authentically Charlie Brown Snoopy Peanuts playhouse. And I loved it that way. I wish there were more than 6 episodes of this, but it's absolutely worth checking out. If you've got kids, or if you just want the nostalgia of Peanuts, you can check out the Snoopy show. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I want to do a spotlight on the movie Breakfast of Champions this week. I know the movie's over 20 years old. And it came out, I think, in 1999. It stars Bruce Willis and Nick Nolte and a whole bunch of people. It actually had a really big cast. But recently I reread Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., which is one of my favorite books of all time. And I wanted to go back and revisit the movie, because I had seen the movie before. But see, I read the book, like, in high school, and then I watched the movie, like, 15 years later and didn't remember how it connected to the book at all. And so I wanted to, after recently rereading it over Christmas break, I wanted to go back and watch the movie. So since it's not available on any streaming service. I was able to find it at the library and I watched it. So I want to kind of give a look at Breakfast of Champions because I never got a chance to cover it because it came out a couple years before I started doing movie reviews. In this adaptation of Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s classic novel, we see a car salesman suffering from a mental breakdown during his midlife crisis.
Dwayne Hoover has it all.
The best employer in town.
There's that smile.
But he's about to lose his mind. In a search for sanity.
Dwayne Hoover, am I losing you?
The only thing anyone's losing around here is their mind, Francine.
But only one man
has
the answer.
Who am I?
She knew the answer. There'd been no more questions.
There's an amazingness to this train wreck that is the Breakfast of Champions movie. It makes every mistake you could possibly make in adapting a Kurt Vonnegut book. I saw this other reviewer, and I can't remember who it was. I think it was linked off of like Wikipedia or something. But this other reviewer pointed out that they spent too much time on the plot of this movie. And normally, that's a good thing. You know, normally it's about plot and characters. But here's the thing. What makes Breakfast of Champions, the book, so brilliant isn't the story. It's not even the characters. It's the approach to the story. As a lot of Vonnegut books do, they sort of have him as a central narrator. And he sort of gives a out-of-the-box description of human life. It's sort of like he's explaining the way the world works circa 1970s, which is when the book was written. He's explaining how that life works to an alien child. And it's just fascinating how he frames it. And then, yeah, there's this story about this Dwayne Hoover who starts to, you know, lose touch with reality during his midlife crisis. But it's not necessarily about him losing touch with reality. It's about him facing the reality of where he is. And the most important character in this book is the narrator, which is Kurt Vonnegut, who literally has a part in the book. About two-thirds of the way through the book, the narrator manifests and shows up in the story. Kurt Vonnegut writes himself literally into the story. And so in this adaptation of the movie, they took out the narrator, which makes the movie almost incomprehensible because it's all about how the narrator looks at things. The other thing this movie does is it aims for happier lives for the people in the movie. In the original book, Dwayne Hoover's wife had committed suicide by drinking Drano. And in the movie, she just talked about it, but she didn't. In the book, he's estranged from his son, Bunny, and has a very unfortunate ending to their relationship that is not mirrored in the movie. They try to go for a happy ending. Kurt Vonnegut's classic character of Kilgore Trout, who's this depressing science fiction writer who can only get published in porno magazines, they try to give him a happy ending. And the book itself is not about that. Nothing about Kilgore Trout ever warrants a happy ending in any of the books that he visits in the Kurt Vonnegut stories. So this movie amplified everything that was unimportant and not only diminished, but got rid of the stuff that made the book unique and amazing. It would be like doing an adaptation of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and completely removing The Hitchhiker's Guide from the story. That's part of the charm of that book. So yeah, when it comes to Breakfast of Champions, the book's amazing. Reread it. It's challenging. It'll challenge your worldview. It's got some incendiary language in there, but that's because of the, when it was written and the intent of the author to show hypocrisy and the caustic nature of humanity. So it can be a little bit of a challenging book to read, especially in this day and age, just because of the language it uses. But overall, it's a brilliant book, but this movie is just a glowing turd of terribleness. So I'm going to have to say the movie Breakfast of Champions totally sucks, but the book's great.
It sucks.
And that's it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Land, French Exit, and Judas and the Black Messiah. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.